Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And today we are talking about more discussions about how publishing should be put together, who should get the money and why. We're talking about RuPaul and Alstora maybe saying take-backsies on selling some of the titles they were interested in. I'm going to put Rebecca on the spot to talk about why publishers should treat us like grown-ups and tell us about the books that we're reading. Some adaptation news, award news. Rebecca, you were out last week. You didn't get to hear, or you didn't get to be here for the first wave of discussing about authors' equity. Danik and I did a very good job of that. I think
Danik did more than
me. In the meantime, Madeline McIntosh did agree to answer a few of my questions for Today in Books. I'll put the links in the show notes there. You and I have both read the answers. Those are unedited, done by email. Caveat. We're going to talk about that a little bit more, maybe do some talk about what's coming up on the Patreon. But before we do any of that, we're going to do a sponsor right now.
Today's episode is brought to you by TorBooks. So if you are a fan of epic fantasy, if you're a fan of Scott Lynch and or Joe Abercrombie, but you want something a little different, you want a hero who's like a bit of a mess, then The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan is for you. In it, Academy dropout / disgraced noble heir Lacan Cordova's life is in shambles. All he's got going for him is, one, he is a card sharp of considerable skill, and two, a lot of, maybe potentially a little too much, wine. So those are the positives. So when the bizarre murder of his father robs him of even the off chance of redemption, Lacan decides to make amends another way. He's going to unravel the mystery behind the killing, even if it takes him to the underbelly of Sophrona, a city of danger, secrets, and merchant princes. Finding the truth is one thing. Finding the truth and staying alive is like a whole other thing. So make sure to check out The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan on sale May 7th. And thanks again to TorBooks for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Do you want to start with author's equity follow-up? You've been marinating on this for 2 weeks. What new axes do you bring to grind? What Hosannas do you are in your throat? Where do you want to go with author's equity and the responses and everything
else? You know, I don't have any Hosannas. There was a piece by Maris Kreisman on LitHub this morning that I just read like 5 minutes before we sat down here. So it did
I'm
not
sure
make
she
it
loved
into...
author's equity.
Did not make it into our call agenda, but I want to shout it out because Maris sums up many of the takes that I have. I think some of the questions and concerns that you and Danica discussed, and just makes a full-throated case that publishing, the headline is, publishing models that rely on gig workers are bad for everybody. Not just from the perspective of, you know, gig work is not great for the people who do it, because it means that you're sort of perpetually behind the eight ball scrambling. Your folks are often overworked. They're working well more than 40 hours a week if they're piecing together multiple freelance gigs or multiple gig economy kinds of work. But she goes the next step to say, this isn't good for the authors that a publisher is trying to serve either. She grounds it in the fact that our regular, everyday, you know, full-time employed publishing workers are often overworked and underpaid. We discussed at length last year the fact that the new floor for full-time salary of $48,000 per year at many of the publishers is still too low. Lots of folks are working a lot of side jobs in order to pay their bills, living in New York especially. And that means that you can't bring your A game often to the primary job if you're also just tired and your brain's doing a lot of other things. And so Kreisman makes the case here that it would be better for everyone if publishing paid workers well and moved in that direction rather than going the direction of we'll pay some freelancers instead of having full-time workers that might unionize, that might negotiate with us, that might cause us to pay them more, because the authors will get better outcomes. You'll have folks who can pay full attention and really bring focus to the work. So I thought that was an interesting angle on it. I liked the four questions that you asked, Madeline McIntosh. These are questions that had been in my mind as well, but particularly about the diversity or the lack thereof among the leadership of author's equity. You noted that diversity and inclusion are not stated among their core principles, and that none of the named members of the staff or any of the named investors appear to be people of color. So you had asked her, are there people of color involved at the beginning? Mm-hmm. If diversity and inclusion is something that author's equity cares about, what practices and policies are going to support that? And she gives a non-answer, you know, about how they are committed to building a diverse team, and that somehow this broader representation will be impacted by the freelancers that they hire. There are problems with that as well. If the way that you're bolstering your DEI numbers and the diversity of your team is by folks who are not getting the benefit of full-time employment, that's not even quite a half measure towards, I think, living into that value. So not the first, I'm sure, to make this remark, and I'm sure we won't be the last either. It's early yet, and I'm excited to see people try new things. Author's equity is heavy hitters. I would like to see them go, like, it's not too late to rethink some of this stuff or to be more expansive in the ways that they are thinking about who they serve, and that you can make money and also have business practices that, you know, really support progressive and inclusive values. So that's where I'm at on that. We'll wait and see. But like Tim Ferriss and James Clear are going to do just fine wherever their books are published.
I think that's, I mean, I'm thinking of it as the war for sticker price, right? Both in the terms of, you know, Danica and I talked about this too, and I wrote it thus in today in books, but like on the publishing side, the retail price that you're going to get from, the wholesale price you're going to get from Amazon for a $30 hardcover is what, $17, something like that?
Yeah.
So that's what author's equity is trying to figure out. How can we redistribute that pie? And then the all stores, the bookshops, the Terulias, the Barnes and Nobles, frankly. Mm-hmm. The Amazons themselves are figuring out what to do with anything they can get above the wholesale price that they're charged by publishers to distribute through. Indie bookstores, too, for that matter. I think it is interesting, and I made this point to Danica, and I've really thought about of late, about how many more people make a full-time living serving publishing in terms of bureaucrats, administrators, marketers, publicists, executives in the publishing industry compared to the number of writers who make an equivalent living from their writing.
Oh, yes.
And I can't help but see a central disjunction there that I feel like there might be a kernel of interestingness to me that Authors Equity is trying to address. I just wish it could be addressed. I feel like, is this the most creative way to do that? Because you'll note the thing that is not contributing to additional authors' pay is executive compensation, because these are people, they are not getting paid $100,000 and driving a Kia. They aren't.
It's a great point. That is
and
a great point.
No one is talking about, wait a minute, maybe the authors get paid more if we didn't have three former CEOs, CMOs of, like, are they taking a huge pay cut from what they got for an equivalent job? I mean, probably at this point. They have investors, which means that this is not just a collective by authors. And I wrote about this in the Deep Dive a long time ago. I talked about it before.
Yes.
My model of author-centered was really more author-centered, like owner-operators.
Yes.
Again, rather than being a part of designing the cover or deciding where the ads go, actually running the show. Brandon Sanderson style, by the way, kind of something like this, where you get a collective together. Notably, the people who are not freelancing here are the executives. And I think that matters.
Yes. I think it matters as well. And one of the additional points that Maris made in her piece for Lit Hub is that, you know, author's equity sounds a lot like actor's equity, which is one of the unions that was on strike this summer that has worked for like more than a century to try to get good pay for working actors. And as we learned during the strikes last year, most working actors are not making full-time money working. So they are just trying to get to the place where they can make decent money and they can focus full time on their acting, or at least be paid
health insurance.
Right.
So they can
at least
work
be paid
at a coffee shop while they're trying to get a gig.
Right. Or if their acting work only takes, you know, half of their working hours every week, at least be paid fairly for that so that they can fill out the rest of their time but not be working 60 or 80 hours a week, not barely affording health care or not affording health care at all. And I think a collective action like you're talking about, an author's equity attempt at publishing that is run by authors and with a focus on the vast majority of authors who are working writers who have day jobs as well. Not the big stars like the Tim Ferrisses and the James Clears. They can afford, as you guys pointed out last week, they can afford to conduct an experiment like this because they can be very confident that they would earn out advances and get, you know, that sweet residual money afterwards. So they can say, we'll just give up the advance. That's not a concern. But for most working writers, the advance is where all of it lives.
Yeah,
and I think if you're really trying to do something that serves authors writ large, not just your big authors, you want to think about a model that is going to, you know, how do you lift up the mid-list writer? How do you lift up the person, the poet who's going to sell a collection that maybe sells 1,000 copies and just wants to earn decent money against that? There's no, you know, real residual plan that's going to make that kind of sustainable for them. There's this vast majority of writers that will not benefit from the model that Authors Equity is putting forth because they can't afford to take the gamble of giving up their advances. The, you know, most mid-list books, most books in general, don't earn out their advance. And I'm sure you guys, you know, covered that last week.
Yep,
so
we did.
I think it's a real who is this business for? Equity for whom? The folks that have been named so far are already quite successful and don't need to be served by a model like this. They stand to profit from it, but this does not look to me like what a new publishing model that really attempts to serve the vast majority of authors, or at least authors who have the most common experience, the most typical publishing experience. This doesn't change anything for those folks.
No, and it probably won't change. I mean, our base case for everything we've been talking about
is that it won't.
Reading for how long is the base case is that it won't. Because I did ask too, it's like, if this works, do you think is this your intent that you think the other publisher should do this? And she kind of walked around that to say, but like there's a kind of logical end to that. Like if it works for authors, then why wouldn't authors opt into doing it? I mean, right? I mean, if this starts working and people are like, yeah, actually, even as a mid-list novel or as a debut novelist, my outcomes are better going with this model. Essentially what that is doing is flowing money from full-time publishing staff to the authors. And I think that maybe being clear-eyed about that is helpful. And I could even see a world in which people argue for that. I guess the piece that is so unsaid here is, what returns are the investors expecting? And why are they the ones that retain their full-time benefits and pay when the publicists, editors, and marketers don't? Because my sense of it is that there are models here. And is there a defector style model for book publishing, I guess, is another way of looking
at it. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I think that's fascinating. There may not be, Rebecca. You may need the glad handers and the deal makers. That's not rhetorical. I don't know enough about how these, to strike a deal with Andrew Wiley to get Salman Rushdie be a part of your thing, that might not be something that an editor who makes $70,000 plus gain share can do, to use the defector model. They may not be able to. But where does the money go? Because unless you're going to sell more, unless you're going to expand the number of titles you sell per copy, or copies per title, or somehow you find more money per copy sold somehow, it's a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
And you're redirecting it. Is this a much more interesting model if a couple of authors say, yeah, we'll do the admin stuff and take higher royalties, but we're not going to have executive pay? That is interesting. now we're cooking with gas here.
Yeah, I think too. If it were set up in more of like a startup model,
yeah,
where, you know, typically founders of a startup are not making bank at the very beginning. Everybody's, you know, scrubbing the floors together. That would be interesting. And that shows a kind of philosophical investment and a literal one on the part of the founders into the mission. Like, we really do want to serve authors more. We want to create something that is more equitable. Any situation where executives are being paid like several multiples of what their lowest paid staff member is making, and like sometimes real orders of magnitude more, is by definition not equitable, no matter how skilled those executives are. Like, we don't have to go down the path of like, no one needs to be making millions and millions of dollars per year. And I don't know how much the executives of Authors Equity are making. I'm sure it's not as astronomical as it would be in other industries, but
maybe they are making zero for 2 years. They could be for all
maybe, maybe. And, but you know what, if they were, they should be talking about that.
Well, like that's a thing they should have done. That's an interesting
thing. That would be a selling point of, here's how much we believe in this model. We are also functionally foregoing advances. If you want to think about it that way.
Yeah. I mean, it would be interesting. I mean, I don't, because I guess it sounds like Maris is arguing that not only is this sort of ethically wrong from a workers' relation equity situation, but also will be materially worse.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of freelancers that work in this industry. I don't know that they are less competent than others.
Yeah,
but what the secondary effects of being all that way all the time are, I'm too far away from the metal of publishing to really have a sense of that.
To clarify it, Maris isn't saying, you know, that a freelancer is less competent than a full-time employee, but that reliance on likely overworked and underpaid freelancers is not any better than reliance on the current overworked and underpaid full-time publishing employees. So if you improve the situation of the average employee and you have full-time folks getting paid well, not having to worry about their health insurance, all of those things, they can do better work on behalf of the authors.
Yeah. This brought up to me, and I think I mentioned this somewhere else, I can't remember, wondering about who the most interesting person in the publishing world is. Because, like, you know, this is a big new idea from heavy hitters. And then I also saw that Brandon Sanderson seemed to have squeezed some concessions from Audible when it comes to independent things. And I'm like, maybe this is an episode that we could do on its own to rank the five or 10 most interesting people in the world of publishing. But I think Sanderson is up there.
Because I agree.
We may not read what he does. Apparently, he's not a very fun hang, which is fine. I would count me, you know, I'm not only the president, I'm a member, or the vice versa. I can't remember how the Hair Club for Men does for people who aren't very good hangs. But, you know, he has figured out a particular way of working for him. I don't believe there are other people being published by Dragon Steel, which I believe is the name of his publishing company.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
But were he to announce tomorrow a slate, an imprint that is publishing new authors, I think automatically becomes the most interesting. And I'm not even sure
I'm not even sure it's close after that. It would be interesting to see him bring some established authors.
Yeah.
Like he has the, you know, real success and sales that he can, you know, flex in the way that he has flexed. And it's exciting to see him do it. Like someone is pushing back and he has found a way to be successful doing this himself outside of the structures and supports of traditional publishing. He has a very engaged audience. Sci-fi fans, genre fans in general, are very into the genres that they read. And I would bet that Brandon Sanderson fans would trust Brandon Sanderson's curation.
Yes.
And if he curated well, a Brandon Sanderson imprint at Dragonsteel, that he's the, you know, acquiring editor of, whether those are established authors or newbies. Like, I mean, that's an incredible way for a new author to break out. But you still can see the appeal for a new author of having the supports of traditional publishing. But Brandon Sanderson wants to like bring along some mid-list sci-fi and fantasy writers, pull them away from their established publishers and give them equity in what he's doing. That would be very compelling. And I think he could do it. I think there are a couple folks in romance that if they wanted to try something like that, a real collective of romance authors could attempt it and probably
be
pretty
one.
Successful.
You get Emily Henry and Jasmine Guillory, and I'm sure
get
some
Sarah
people
McLean.
I don't even know that move units. And because romance does already have a willingness of its core hardcore audience to go self-publish direct.
Right.
That you could maybe, you know, maybe it's not of a detriment that your book isn't carried at the front of Powell's because it's already not getting put there anyway for romance. Now Barnes & Noble. By the way, I was banging on Powell's locally for not having a display of adapted screenplay things. I walked by yesterday.
Yes.
They had one. Would you like to know what the name of their display was called?
Oh, is it really good or really bad?
I can't comment. Yeah, till I tell you what it is.
Okay,
and you'll know
tell
why
me,
I can't.
Tell me.
Adaptation Nation.
Oh!
Is there a listener out there? Or is that so obvious? I can't tell.
I don't
know. Is
that
know. An obvious
Either
thing
way.
To name it? Anyway,
Adaptation
that was the name of our
Nation.
That was the name of our experimental adaptation podcast, for those of you who don't know, by the way. So, flattered, intrigued to see that out there. So, a point of order for that. I guess we're going to follow this pretty closely. It will be fascinating to see. I am of the opinion now, because as you know, I've been fully Sinekin-pilled by big fiction when it comes to corporate publishing.
Yeah, you have.
But in this regard of like, maybe corporate publishing was a mistake and there's not as much margin there to serve what a corporate international conglomerate that's publicly traded wants to do.
The way it's set up now is a mess.
It doesn't seem to, well, unless it does work. But like that siphoning off some of those dollars per copy sold is going to, you know, a German or French conglomerate overseas. Sure. I mean, that's capitalism, but not all businesses, especially services industry, was frankly much of what public. It's IP and services. That's what the publishing industry is. You know, that tends not to be where you can reinvest capital. It's hard for Random House to make a bunch of money, take that money, reinvest it into the company and do better every year, because it's services, culture and services company tend not to work that way. And this is repeating that mistake where there's investors who are expecting presumably some kind of return. I think the same story of there are no investors and we're bootstrapping this and the profits are part of what's subsidizing this is more interesting. Like it's
I do too.
I think that's more interesting.
And when you
too.
Said a couple minutes ago, like maybe it works, I think it really depends on what your definition of
works
is. Like
that's right.
I would say that an industry that is set up where the lowest paid employees that do most of the grunt work are not making even close to what a living wage is in their city is not an industry that works.
So yeah, that's probably a broader net, I guess, when you think about the publicly traded companies or even subsidiaries of things that are listed internationally. Okay, speaking of people vying for a piece of your book buying dollar and redistribute it to themselves or authors or whatever, Alstora, I actually have to admit I didn't anticipate this. I should have probably expected. Now, I'm not in the spaces where I am sure the critiques of Alstora were the most vociferous. If it makes it to me, I can assume that people even closer to this issue in these communities were louder.
Yes.
But RuPaul reversed the decision to keep stocking anti-LGBTQ books. Danica and I were talking about the reality of what we assumed is happening, which is they're being fulfilled by Ingram, and having a really hard time. Basically, you have 10 million ISBNs that you've got to comb through if you're going to keep the bad guys out, essentially, or the ones that you don't want out. I don't know. So they're still going to sell them, it sounds like. But they are going to donate the proceeds from those sales to their own philanthropic initiative, the Rainbow Bus. It doesn't sound like they're going through one by one, but did I misread this, or is that your understanding?
You did misread it. Yeah, no, it says they will. This updated piece by Abby Montiel from Them says they will, in fact, no longer carry the books, but the decision comes after significant controversy. How they're going to go about no longer carrying these books is a great question. Because in the universe of millions and millions of ISBNs, you know, I'm sure that anybody who cares about this kind of stuff, including us, could off the dome list, you know, a dozen people that like, okay, these books should probably not be there. But there's a lot more than that in the universe of like bigoted, gross, anti-LGBTQ titles. And how do you operationalize that when you're using, you know, a big distribution service like Ingram? This isn't like when you open an indie bookstore and you get to pick and choose which books you bring physically into the store. That makes it much easier to screen and to decide. You just don't order the ones, you know, by the people that you don't want to support. But even, you know, indie bookstores that make those choices, this is a unique situation, I think, because to my understanding, indie bookstores that are having a lot of their fulfillment done by Ingram as well, and a lot of indie bookstores are doing that. Like, you go into your indie bookstore, they've got the book there, but if they don't have it and they order it for you, it very likely will just come to you directly from an Ingram warehouse at this point.
Yep.
I don't believe that there's, if there are, I haven't heard of any indies that are gating what their customers can buy online through them. So the Alstora attempting to do this is, to my knowledge, a first. If anybody listening knows of indie bookstores that have figured out ways to gate their online offerings through the Ingram catalog, I would love to hear about it. podcast@bookriot.com. Tell us how. And if anybody happens to know how Alstora is going to do it, I would really love to know, because like, I have no idea how you attempt to. It's a giant game of whack-a-mole. And I don't think they anticipate. Clearly, they didn't anticipate
they didn't
this
know.
Kind of question.
They didn't know. They didn't know. They did not know.
This is
how this
also
works.
Right. One of the things that happens when people who aren't familiar with the world of books and reading decide to enter the world of books and reading is like, oh, we're responsible for this now. People care about what kinds of books we platform and give others access to. Seems obvious when you're on the inside, but they clearly, no one had told them this was a thing to expect. And so my expectation at this point is they will somehow block a bunch of ISBNs from the Alstora online store. And they will regularly hear from customers or people who would like to be customers or people who are just mad at them about other titles that are offensive or potentially offensive that are still available. And the game of whack-a-mole just goes on and on. I just don't know how you actually execute this.
Yeah, I think you... Now, maybe it's enough to get people to quiet down. It could be. Maybe you're not going to get them all off, but maybe you get the worst ones off, the ones people notice. You have an email that you people can submit, and maybe you're promiscuous in removing listings. Because are you going to adjudicate every single one? Is everyone, every time someone emails you, are you like, sure, I'll take that off? Because guess what? This is hard to
it
figure
is hard.
Out. What if you get a marginal case? And there are a lot of them. What if someone thinks one book is anti-trans, but the other one thinks that it's not? Or whatever else the case may be. These are not cut and dry, generally speaking. But maybe if you take care of the cut and dry ones, you take care of the most acute problem you have right now, which is the very people who might be interested in supporting your store now see that you're selling Mein Kampf,
right?
Which is not a look anybody needs.
Right. There are also new books of this kind coming out all the time. Yep. And so like now someone has to pay attention to the right-wing nut jobs who publish these kinds of things, figure out where to find those people, figure out what books they're publishing, and then block those as they come out? Like, someone is going to have to adjudicate.
I think they're still going to be reactive. They're going to wait for someone to raise a flag. I think that's the only, listen.
That's the only feasible.
That's the only feasible way. Because there's two ways of doing these things. You can either curate or you don't. That's it.
Right.
Because anything else is decision made. That's right. It. If you're curating, you're making decisions, or you just aren't making decisions.
And
that's it. Those are the only two options.
If it's going to be only reactive, then like all the bottles of whiskey in the world to whoever runs social media for them and whoever has to read those emails, because that's just a never ending barrage of people being mad that somebody gross published a book and you let it be available at all in your online store. Like, if it's always reactive, then you get half a cookie for removing it. But the first thing will be, it should never have been there in the first place. And you're absolutely correct. Like, you know, LGBTQ folks and people who support them are not monolithic. And so there will be no agreement. There's no 100% agreement about most of these for what should and shouldn't be there. It's like when you open the door to, you can email us and tell us which titles we shouldn't have in our store.
Yep.
That's a door that you will never succeed in closing in any way that is satisfying to customers. Like, I do not envy them this position that they're in. I kind of think that the move here would have been to say, here's how our fulfillment works.
Yes.
We are white labeling a giant book warehouse. We do not have the capacity to do these things. And in the case that someone publishes an anti-LGBTQ book from us, like, we think that's going to be very minimal. We'll do what we can to donate profits, whatever.
Where's that list, though? Then you have to curate that list.
Yeah, right. How do you even? I think you just say, this is the deal.
Yeah.
Here's how this works. Treat me like a grown-up. Here's the deal. Like, you know, Mein Kampf, yes, we can take that out. But we're not going to be in the business of, you know, answering every email, and then someone has to decide. Some human has to decide on the behalf of this entire company now which books can and can't be listed. And by the time you've made one change, that list is already out of date. Like, it's unsustainable. And a lot of this is going to be done, like, the activism around this is done and will continue to be done online. So it's just, I mean, I would hate to be running social media for all Stora, knowing that, like, okay, even if we get these out, like, it's just looming that, you know,
bigot is published every day.
Right. Yep. Yeah. The next time a new gross TikTok star puts out a book and we don't know about it first, everyone's going to be mad at me again that day that it was out. Then you take it down and then there's another one. It's just like, talk about a real Sisyphean feat here.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the first fork in the road is whether or not you try to do something like this at all, right? So, you know, whether you think that's practicable. The second one is there a different way that you could have launched this and made and hung a lantern on the constraints and say, yes, we are using Ingram. Yeah. But we realize that Ingram's availability means we get to do something other people aren't. Will it be perfect? No. Will it be better? Will it be the best place to find books by these community members? Yes. Will we be doing more than anybody else to delist or not, you know, promote books that are against our values? Yes. Will we get them all? No. Do we want you to help us? Yes. Will it be messy? Yeah. I mean, that's the only way I think you could have done something like this.
Not to mention that all of this assumes that someone who wants to buy an LGBTQ book is going to Google that book and then choose to buy it
from
RuPaul's bookstore.
Comes and buys the Libs of TikTok founder's book. Is it an accident? The SEO?
Right. First of all, talk about SEO. If someone is sitting down and they're just trying to Google and find that book, they're going to get an Amazon link, and then they're going to get a Barnes & Noble link, and then they're going to get some other online retailer link. All Stora is going to come very low on the list of Google returns, maybe not even the first page, probably not even the first page, unless they have some real search engine wizards. And then let's say it does happen. Somebody wants your anti-LGBTQ book, and they magically land at All Stora. If they click around a little bit, they are going to figure out who they're buying this book from, and that the profits will, you know, some of the profits are going to go to RuPaul. Some of the profits are going to go to gay people. They do not want that. So, like, in a way, there's a straw man happening here. Like, I understand customers being upset that these books are even available, showing up as available, because Alstora did not explain to them what it means to be pulling from Ingram's catalog. But like the likelihood that that availability has any kind of material impact or benefit to the writers of those books by way of Alstora is so, so minimal.
Yeah. No, I mean, there, some of it is perception and some of it is real. Right. But even if they had said, we can't curate, you know, we don't have control of everything, but we have curated our list to some degree. We probably didn't catch everything. If you see something, we'll take a look at it. But then you wouldn't have these really glaring examples from day one. I think a little bit of vigilance would have gone a long way. And again, you're also not going to please everyone. There are going to be some people that think, if you have one book with one scene that I think is damaging to people I care about, I think you're doing something bad. And they're entitled to that opinion. To be clear, I don't know if I agree with it or not, but those people aren't going to go away, and that's becomes impossible. But are you pleasing the people you want to please is a good question. I don't even think they did that here. I think there's a world in which maybe, you know, and this is easy for me to say, I am not a marginalized people, and I do not feel the reality, weight, and everyday existence of what it means to live in a world where these books are about my core humanity. So take everything I'm saying with a grain of salt. I think there is a good version of this that is additive to people's choices for where they buy books that could have happened. And it's a shame that it went this way. Mm-hmm. And I think this thing is now DOA. That's my ultimate. I don't think this is too much for something to, why would someone give them a chance now?
Anything like this isn't like any business like this is an uphill battle anyway when you're competing against folks like Amazon. But I agree. I think this is DOA. Not to mention that the Alstora folks need a refresher in what censorship versus curation means.
Yep.
There are some notes in this piece that the FAQ page, which has since been edited on Alstora, at one point stated that censorship of any book, perspective, or story is incompatible with the survival of democracy, and that banning books is never the answer. Those are true statements that I agree with, and they also have nothing to do with what a private business determines about their stock and what they will or won't sell.
That's right. Just for the record, one of the books mentioned here, What is a Woman by Matt Walsh, which is apparently an anti-trans book. I know nothing about it. You can buy from Bookshop right now through the independent bookshop of your choice.
You can buy Mein Kampf from Bookshop. I just checked.
just to be fair to, I mean, I don't know if it's being fair to Alstora, but just to talk about, like, we know what we're talking about when it comes to how these platforms work.
I would bet you probably can't walk into most of your local indies and get a copy of Mein Kampf, but if you pull up bookshop.org, you can do it. And because they're also dealing with the universe Ingram. Of millions and millions of ISBNs and Ingram fulfillment.
That's right. And they will make money off that. The bookstore and bookshop will make money off that. There's nothing. Here's another thing. If you click through an Amazon affiliate link on Book Riot Deals or someone else, and you go buy the same books through Amazon, we'll get a percentage of that. We just will.
Yep.
You know, but we don't run Amazon. We're responsible for what we link to, but post-linking,
I've seen the things people buy from our Amazon links. I don't want to be responsible for any of it.
There are bejeweled objects that you do things with that I cannot mention here that we have seen. And have a great time. I'm hoping you're enjoying.
I love this for you.
That's really great for you. Okay.
Bejeweled objects that you do things with.
What about, I guess the last thing, and I think Danica and I talked about, what about a version of this that rather than be reactively curated was proactive? We carry 5,000 titles.
Mm-hmm.
And you just did it that way.
Yeah. I think that's great. 5,000 is way more books than most people are going to read in their lifetime.
The problem we also know is that the lion's share of book sales are long tail backlist.
Yeah.
So does that first 5,000 cover everything someone might want to buy from you? Probably not. Does it hurt your membership $5 a month case that you can't buy everything from them? Probably. So there's some weird strategy taxes going on at the same time. A fascinating, one of the more interesting stories
we've come across. That a real interesting mess in many ways.
Interesting mess. Let's take a quick second sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Jean and Louise can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
New England getting in the game of anti-book ban measures. This is Delaware and Connecticut. In Delaware, it's HB 299. The Libraries for All Act would strengthen the right to read by designating libraries as a place of public accommodation. That would put libraries under Delaware's Equal Accommodations Law. Delaware Library Consortium would then need to develop and adapt policies which define equitable access and the right to read for all state residents. Very interesting to put it under existing law. This is one of Kelly's great missives reporting from this world to see there. In Connecticut, House Bill 5417 focused solely on schools and what entities do and do not have the right to ban materials within those institutions. The bill would restrict school boards across the state from banning materials for the following reasons. There's a whole bunch of them. Partisan approval or disapproval, an author's race, nationality, gender, sexual orientation, or political or religious views, those which are protected classes, by the way, I think, except for nationality. Actually, sexual orientation is not a protected class.
No.
At this point, that is bad. We should do something about that. Rebecca, you listen to political podcasts. Why don't you go take care of that?
And then, call your reps, folks.
And related to sexual health. So, you know, the normal stuff that you hear about, they're trying to make a blanket rule. May your efforts succeed. I have nothing
May
else
your
to say
efforts
there.
Succeed. Yeah. Nice to see it. I was reading this morning that currently 20 states have measures like this either already passed and on the books or in process. So we are rolling to the point where almost half of U.S. states have active measures against anti-book banning.
Do any of them went for Trump have it? Do you know? I mean, this is a map that I'd like to see.
Oh,
is there
that's a good question.
Is there an Indiana or something out there that got on board? Kansas? I guess Kansas was thinking about it. I don't
know. Kansas was working on it. Yeah. Kansas politics, speaking of, have been fascinating lately, especially
Kansas
around this
real,
stuff.
It's a real thing.
That's a graphic I would like to see. Maybe we can work on some.
I mean, again,
how much
it's
light
better
exists
to have protections
between,
in the places that are amenable to it, but these are all those places. These are also places less likely to have the most draconian of these rules, but you do what you do. You do what you can do.
Sure.
Let's talk about your piece.
Okay.
Did you do the sponsor break already? I can't remember.
I think you did.
Okay.
You said there's going to be a sponsor break.
Sorry, I didn't write it down. Well, if there wasn't,
welcome
there
to
is
podcasting.
Now. Yep. Okay, let's talk about your piece that you were writing today in relationship to an underknown author, really, Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
yeah, maybe you've heard of him.
Maybe you've heard of them. Well, I'll cede the floor to you for a minute. Why don't you give the people your 30-second Axios version of the piece you wrote for
Gabriel Okay. Okay. Gabriel Garcia Marquez died 10 years ago. He was suffering from dementia, had memory loss associated with it. 10 years prior to that, in 2004, he had shelved for the last time the working material of a novel. He had about 800 pages of working material, various drafts and notes and like fragments of things. And he told his sons the novel doesn't work, and he instructed them to destroy it. They've honored that for the last 10 years, and then they reversed course. They say they went back, they read the draft. They think it's better than their father estimated it to be. They think that perhaps his mental state at the time that he last read it and requested that they destroy it had been impacted by dementia, and that maybe they had made a mistake in terms of, you know, honoring his legacy and giving the world of books and reading, the literary community, access to it. So they have published, they've Frankensteined together a 144-page novella with the help of, you know, editors and folks at Random House. Yeah. That was published this week, called Until August. I read like half a dozen pieces about this when I got back from vacation last week, between folks being like, this is a travesty, you've gone against your dead father's wishes, and then other people saying, you know, give it to us for the legacy, you know, for the sake of history, everyone should see these kinds of things. And then all kinds of mixed reviews about what actually, how good or not is this thing. So my take is not like, I'm not interested really in another round of should literary executors publish work that the deceased author asked them not to publish, because we know this is a thing. Like, the executor, there are a lot of compelling incentives to do it. Literary executors and publishers are going to continue to do this. And I want to live in the realm of reality and acknowledge that. I just want them to do it better, because it's being marketed as a rediscovered Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel. If you're thinking, I've heard Rebecca yell about this before, it's because this feels very similar to calling Go Set a Watchman a sequel to To Kill a Mockingbird, when that also was a draft. And also Harper Lee had requested that it never see the light of day. I think her reasons were very good for that. I did read Go Set a Watchman. I have not read Until August yet, so I don't have an opinion on like what this does to his legacy or not. I think the top line note is, he's Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He won a freaking Nobel Prize. What you release after his death is not going to impact his legacy unless it's like really, really terrible. And I don't think it's really terrible, but just do better by readers. Like, first of all, we're smart and we know what's going on here. Just tell us the truth, that you believe that this story needs to be told. You believe that readers should have access to it. Here is how we took 800 pages of material and constructed what we believe to be the author's vision for this novella. Here's how we found these notes that were an early draft of To Kill a Mockingbird, and what we understand to be Harper Lee's decisions about how to change the story for what became the book you're familiar with. Here's why we are publishing this version. Like, put it front and center and call it what it is, and trust readers. Like, there are enough real, legit reasons to be interested in that. If you care about Gabriel Garcia Marquez, there are reasons to be interested in, like, what was he working on? What have they put together? If you loved To Kill a Mockingbird, there's a reason to be curious about, like, how could Atticus Finch have turned out in a different version? What kinds of decisions did Harper Lee make along the way? Just tell us the truth. Like, it's so insulting that publishers package things this way. And it's just, to me, such a clear choice to prioritize a profit incentive by packaging something dishonestly when it's unnecessary. Like, first of all, don't do that. It's dishonest. But secondly, you don't need to. You could tell the truth about what these things are.
You don't lose one sale if you say, this has been edited and assembled by this person and this person, who's a Marquez scholar, and their great granddaughter, who has been a lifetime curator and protector and advocate for her father, ancestors' work. You know, if you want to read more about which is which, there's an appendix, or you can go to this website or whatever. I don't even think you have to put it in the book, just that it's available somewhere and that you hang a lantern on. This is like, Marquez did not sit down right day and write all of these words in order exactly like this. I mean, most books aren't that way anyway, but this is even something more than that.
Yeah,
I agree with you. I don't see the downside. Like, I was in the liquor store the other day. I promise this is going somewhere.
And, okay, let's go.
There was a big sign that says, you know, smoking kills 1,200 people a day. Like, a huge sign.
Mm-hmm.
That
said, you know, and it's right in front of the cigarettes.
It's right in front of the cigarettes. And you know what? People still smoke cigarettes.
They do.
And you can say that's right or wrong, but they do. And they know what they're getting into. And the tobacco industry would have not imploded like it did if it had done this in the 50s rather than hide and do all the other kind of stuff. And I'm not equating it, but I'm saying that very rarely does giving a consumer the real reasons for something being the way they are backfire if those reasons aren't nefarious. You're not saying this was churned out by ChatGPT, right? You're not saying that this was, there was a one sentence here and we hired someone to ghostwrite the rest of it. It sounds to me like this is mostly Marquez doing Marquez things, and it sounds and feels like Marquez. And that's enough. I mean, I think that's fine. This makes me nuts, too, because I have a little bit, even more than you, I think I have a little bit of the scholar in me. Like, I want to know where the seams are and how these things are put together. But, like, yeah, I mean, I don't know that people are going to be out there who just, all they've read is 100 Years of Solitude, and they're going to pick up this book, and if they see there's an introduction explaining, like, yeah, I'm not reading this one. I just don't, that's a weird story. I don't see that happening.
Yeah, I think just make it front and center. Have the brothers, in this case, Marquez's sons, write an interesting introduction about the whole thing. Like, because right now they're on a publicity apology tour. There are these profiles and interviews of them all over the place where they're saying, like, we know this looks like a cash grab. We promise that's not what we're after. We were conflicted about it. Here's our thinking. Here's all the material that we had. And then you've got like the scholars arguing about whether it should have been done or not. Like, can we just spill our ink on something more interesting, please?
Most encounter with this book is going to be the book, not an interview in living. It's not gonna happen or listening to our show.
And I think that's also, like, right now that's by design. We're gonna sell this rediscovered Gabrielle
convenient
Garmin.
Right, it's awfully yes convenient.
And only the nerds that are paying attention or who want to go Google it are going to figure out what it actually is. But this, it points back to a broader issue that I see in publishing and like how synopses and blurbs are written. Like, the job of a synopsis or a blurb is to sell a book, and the publisher wants to get you as the reader over the finish line to making the purchase. Often, I think synopses are written in a short-sighted manner where they're compelling for a purchase, but then what's inside the book does not match up with the experience that the synopsis tells you you're going to have, which hamstrings an author and makes it less likely that you're going to buy that author's next book or that you're going to trust the synopsis on the next one. Like, truth in marketing matters because your trust is the most, like, a consumer's trust is the most valuable thing that anyone trying to sell a product has. So reader's trust is the most valuable asset that publishers and authors have. And if you continue to erode it by marketing things as something that they aren't, like, first of all, we know that's what you're doing, and there's no reason to be doing it in these cases, and it makes us less likely to trust the next one. Like, just, you know, put on the package what the thing actually is and let consumers make decisions. And if it turns out that when you tell the truth about it, people don't want the thing, well, that's interesting data too. I don't think that's the data they would get. I think this thing would continue to sell. It would be just fine. Yep. But if it turns out, like, oh, if you tell them it's not actually rediscovered, it was Frankensteined together, people don't want it, well, then maybe we can spend less time doing that and lying about it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's an example out there. If you're a publishing pro that knows something like this, it's hard to think of an example of a book that tried to market itself as a head fake. I mean, these are a different example because it's not really a head fake. It's more of a misrepresentation. But when it comes to blurbing and synopses, some book that became a hit because it misrepresented itself in a blurb or synopsis, like, this doesn't go well. People don't go recommend a book that wasn't what they thought
it was going to be. No, and I mean, a recent example, and I loved the book, is Bonnie Jo Campbell's new novel.
Yeah.
Is packaged as great for readers of Where the Crawdads Sing. It's about women. It takes place in a completely different kind of environment. There's a lot of stuff about nature in it. Those are the common themes. The writing is excellent, which Where the Crawdads Sing is not. It is, like, there are no things that are really meaningful that Bonnie Jo Campbell has in common with the work of Delia Owens. And that does a disservice to the readers all the way around. If what you want is a book like Where the Crawdads Sing and you pick up the Bonnie Jo Campbell, you're not getting what you want. And if you're a reader who is interested in the kind of work that Bonnie Jo Campbell does, you're not going to pick up a book that says it's great for readers of Where the Crawdads Sing. So, like, that kind of comp happens often, and it's a very weak link, and I don't think that it ultimately serves the book or the readers. Yeah.
On to the question of whether or not you should do stuff with this. I am team maximalist. I don't think this comes as any surprise, but...
put it all out there.
There are so many examples of books and transcendent, enduring works that if someone had listened to someone on their deathbed or followed something they said at a cocktail party before they died, like, we wouldn't have the Aeneid by Virgil, who wanted to burn, right? Like, we wouldn't have the poems of, like, I think Emily Dickinson, Zora Neale Hurston was out there one day burning stuff in her trash can, and someone's like, whoa, Zora, hold on. So I'm very much of the case that posterity benefits if we kind of are more, I don't know, expansive in our thinking about what can someone's literary legacy be. Now, having said that, I do draw the line myself on, like, personal diaries and letters and stuff.
I agree.
Like, if something's, like, was even broadly intended to maybe be something for public consumption, I'm cool. Also, if you want something burned, do it while you're alive.
Yeah, that's about where I shake out on it. I think I am less invested in that because I'm, you know, just less of a literary historian than you are. But in many ways, I feel like I'm dead. What difference does it make to me anyway?
Yeah, so, I, like, mean, do you get to control how you might have felt about everything forever related to you? Probably not.
Right.
I mean, here's one thing. Eventually, and your work will be in the public domain. I mean, it just will.
And that,
if it's
that distinction. Yeah, that distinction between things that are clearly intended to be private work and things that were, like, drafts of a book that would have gone to public publication. That's an important distinction, but I also lean to the side of, like, put that out there, let the historians and the literary community decide and really just make wise decisions as the people in charge of protecting someone's legacy. If the thing is terrible, you can make a wise decision not to publish it. But if you think this was pretty good, it's better than our dying father thought it was when he was incapacitated, put it out there and tell the whole story. It's all I just do better.
Yeah. And, or, you know, don't include it in the executorship. Say, I assume that you could write into your will or trust or whatever, absolutely under no circumstances use any of the pages related to what and call it anything. I don't know enough about probate law to know if that would hold up, if there's a ways around that. But at some point, the people you've made your executors or acceptors, you're saying, I trust you to do.
Right. I trust your judgment.
Yeah. And, you know, that not something that abrogate that, but I can also think of an author who, you know, had a reputation and then something got published that they wouldn't have wanted published. And they're like, you know what, that, you know, who sucks? That dude. Like, I just can't think of an example of, like, someone getting wrecked by something like this. Most of the time it's the thing they did get published. They're like, actually, I mean, maybe not so much with that.
Actually, most of the time, it's just like the bad shit that they did in their personal lives that comes out later that ruins a legacy. It's not, you know, the half-baked draft of a novel that's going to ruin the legacy of someone who won a Nobel Prize.
That's right. All right. Well, I think we should end it there today. Podcast at bookriot.com. If you've got feedback, check for a newsletter coming tomorrow.
Yes.
That includes one of, if not the... best email we've ever gotten. I've got some other stuff to throw at Rebecca. I may do a live transcription of a live pun I made at Rebecca yesterday if it gets past the censors and she can vouch or not for how much I have embellished or debellished the truth of the matter. But look for that there. Patreon, right after this, we're recording our Insta-buy authors for the Patreon next week. So you can check that out. Do we want to tease? How many do you have on your list?
Let's see. Like, more than a dozen. The list is longer than I thought it was going to be.
I've got 32 on mine at this point. So we'll see how many of them line up. I'm guessing we're going to have some pretty good overlap, but it'll be interesting to see what we don't have. Mm-hmm. And Better Living Through Books, first edition is up and running. Today in Books, the BREU, all the links are in the show notes there. And the show notes, of course, are in your podcatcher or at bookriot.com/listen. Rebecca, thank you as always. We'll be right back.